Good morning, everybody. Last weekend, I was walking through a city further south with a good friend, and along the main tourist street, we saw a young woman, similar age to our daughters, sitting on the street with a blanket and her dog beside her. She was asleep, and it was obvious from the needle marks on her hands and arms that she was really in quite a state. We were on holiday, and my first thoughts as I saw her in the distance was, oh no, not today. I didn't want to engage with her, not today. And yet as we approached her, I felt an overwhelming sense of pity for her. She was someone's daughter. She could have been mine. So what to do? My first reaction was the same as the crowd in this story today. Shh, don't disturb me. I'm on holiday. Not today. We're having a good time. And it was to my shame. When I first became a Christian some 40 years ago, and I first read this account of Bartimaeus, I wasn't aware of people begging in the streets of the towns and cities. I hardly saw any, and yet now, all of us, as we think about it, we see a growing number of people on our streets, in our cities and towns, not only here but throughout the world, begging to survive. Some are there because circumstances cause their lives to implode, and suddenly absolutely everything's gone. Some because they're born into poverty. Christians Against Poverty, the charity in this country, has many testimonies of families in this sort of distress, and they're working to lift them out of that sort of poverty. And then others have fallen into some form of addiction that numbs any reaction to any of the passing crowd, like the young woman in the city we saw. No one really chooses to live that way of life. And often we don't know what to do as we pass by, do we? Because we're embarrassed, or we don't know what to say or how to respond. For me, sometimes I pass by. And, I feel desperately uncomfortable every time I do that. I know that to offer money might only go towards feeding an addiction. But then again, it might not. And sometimes, like last weekend, we bought some food and some drink and some food for the dog to help in some small way. Or maybe it just made us feel better. I'm not sure. There's a mix of stuff going on, but it always feels like a sticking plaster on a massive open wound. But this morning we're going to Jericho. It's one of the oldest inhabited cities in the world. It's located not far from the Jordan crossing, the River Jordan crossing, and it's an oasis in the desert. And when Jim and I were there, it was really hot and dusty, and the road from Jericho to Jerusalem, it's about 15 miles long, and it's uphill all the way. As we meet Bartimaeus, we're coming to the last part of Jesus' ministry as we read that he is leaving Jericho to go up to Jerusalem. Now, before he started this journey, Jesus had already told his disciples three times that he was going to Jerusalem to be crucified and he would come back to life. He would rise again. But still, at this time, they didn't see the full meaning of what he was saying to them. And they're not alone. If we're all honest, we too find it hard to see clearly who Jesus really is and the profound significance of what he has won for us on the cross. On his way to Jerusalem, Jesus had a lot on his mind. This was the last time he'd walk that road, and he would be crucified very soon. Now, Bartimaeus was a beggar at the time, and beggars were a common sight in most towns. Anyone with a crippling disease or disability usually ended up begging for survival. And blindness was considered a curse from God for sin, so it made matters even worse for people like Bartimaeus. And this account, you must have noticed that it's short, it's fast moving, and it's gone, it's done before you can pick out some of the treasures that are in it. So let's just for a moment just try to put ourselves in the shoes of Bartimaeus this morning. If you're begging, you must get used to people ignoring you, smiling in a patronising way, stopping to talk for a moment, then hurrying on because you don't know what else to say. You get used to sitting there in the heat and the cold, hoping for enough to get you through the next day, the next, and then do it all over again. It's not much of a life, but it's the one you know, and you have no choice. Poverty robs you of having choice. The people in Jericho, he would have known, they'd have seen him day by day out begging, and in a way he depended on their goodwill. So here's a man who can't see. He's hearing, because sight loss, people, the hearing is sharper because you're having to really concentrate, and it's often sharper than those who have vision. And he hears that it's Jesus of Nazareth coming his way. But Bartimaeus says it's Jesus, son of David. Jesus, son of David, means he's the long-expected Davidic king, the fulfillment of the promised one in the Old Testament. This is the Messiah. Bartimaeus showed amazing spiritual insight here. He may have been blind, but the eyes of his heart were wide open. And the great crowd following Jesus doesn't appear to see what he sees. But Bartimaeus, who has the limitation of being blind, somehow perceives more than everybody else that this Jesus is the promised one of God. But it's even more than that in this passage. Somehow Bartimaeus says Jesus is not just the son of David, but he provides mercy. So he cries out, "Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me." It was all he could muster. Have mercy on me. He's absolutely destitute. Bartimaeus can't help himself, but he has enough faith to perceive that his limitation, his absolute need, will be met in Jesus. I think that when we hit those times in our lives when we can acknowledge our own limitations, we come to the end of our rope, end of our tether. Our own absolute need of Jesus and his mercy. It frees us to do something like Bartimaeus did. What I mean is that you know, at times like this, you not only see more than others through your spiritual eyes, as it were, but you can also risk more than others. Even if that risk is just pressing in on faith, no matter how small that faith might be, but pressing in until we perceive God at work in our lives, and gradually the darkness that once gathered is dispersed by the light and the life of Jesus as we see him at work in our lives. The risk is obvious in verse 47 when he cries out, "Jesus, have mercy on me." You know, that's a risky exposure in which he's admitting, "I can't fix what's wrong, Jesus. I need you." But with that call to Jesus for mercy, Bartimaeus is also telling Jesus, I can't fix it, but I know you can. You're the son of David, and I believe that you are the one who can fix things. And in the middle of this crowd, of this noise, who were following Jesus, he risked alienating himself from the very people he needed to depend on. His faith enabled him to believe even when he couldn't see. And I'm going to ask Steve Tollefield to come now, and he's going to share something of his own testimony of those times when he too has acknowledged his own need of Jesus. So Steve, would you like to come?
Thank you. I don't know if you watch Rev at all. We've got it on DVD and all three series. And in every episode of that program, there's a time when the Reverend Smallbone prays. It's one of the features of the program. And there's one particular episode when he's got to look after this little girl who's completely obnoxious. She arrives, appears to be pleasant, but as soon as her parents have gone, she turns into an absolute monster. And at one point in the program, he can't find her. She's disappeared completely. And he's totally and utterly at his wit's end, and he's charging around and trying to find her. And during that, he prays, and we'll come back to what he prays in a moment. One of the secrets of the Christian life is to build things into your life before things happen, because quite often you can't, when things do go terribly wrong, it's too late to try and find something to help you through it. And an example of that is trying to read the book of Job when you're depressed. Best to read it when you're not depressed, and then when you are, then the lessons that are there fit into your life. Now, one of the things I discovered in the 1980s, as long ago as that, was this little booklet called The Power of the Name, which is about the Jesus Prayer. And you can still get this booklet from the Sisters of the Love of God. You can't borrow mine because you'll never give it back. But this is an old edition, but it's never gone out of print. Now, it's something from Greek Orthodox tradition, and quite a bit is claimed for it. But basically what it is, the prayer, the Jesus prayer, as simple as it is Lord Jesus, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And you'll notice how similar that is to the prayer of Bartimaeus. And quite a bit it is claimed for it, and it's recommended that it's used quite a lot. So, for example, you can use it whilst dressing, washing up, mending socks, digging in the garden, walking, driving, waiting in the bus queue, so on and so on. But part of the distinctive value of the Jesus Prayer lies in precisely the fact of its radical simplicity. It can be prayed in conditions of distraction, where more complex forms of prayer are impossible. It is especially helpful in moments of tension and grave anxiety. So to go back to the Reverend Smallbone charging around in that episode, if you watch the program and if you know the Jesus Prayer, you will notice that that is the only prayer he can pray. It's the only thing he can pray, because it's impossible to focus or try and, in any way, vocalize or your concerns and so on. You are in such a thing of distress, because there cannot be anything worse than losing a child that's gone, and you cannot, so that's it, you're at your end, and that's all you can pray. So this is something I was aware of, in a sense. It's something that I'd sort of tried a bit with, but hadn't, used at the time, but it sort of slipped. Then, as Marion says, I did come to an end of myself at one point. In fact, I've had two major depressive episodes, and this particularly concerns the first of these, not so much the second. It was relatively a little while after the death of my father and other things as well. But, you know, you could, I'm sure you know this kind of thing, factors that can lead up to this. And I got to the state of, you know, if you know how it can be, it's particularly difficult. And, you know, people will say, oh, you know, pull yourself together and, you know, let's go away and find something, you know, to cheer you up. And let's go to church, worship God, etc., etc. In fact, this in many ways is the worst part of it, because coming to church, particularly coming here, precisely here in this building, it made me just feel worse, not better. Worshipping God didn't make me feel better, it made me feel worse. And, you know, I'd literally have to go down and sit in the toilet, quite frankly. And the only thing that at that stage it was possible to do is the Jesus Prayer, because you can do that when you've got nothing else that's still there, and it still works. So there we are, the Jesus Prayer.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thank you for sharing your heart with us. Sometimes when we do come to church as Christians, and we come with a lot of baggage sometimes, a lot of pain. We don't know quite what to do with ourselves. And this was a place where Bartimaeus was. He had nowhere else to go apart from Jesus. And, you know, when we hear from Steve that during a time when he was in such pain through depression, needed to leave the very place where most of the time we find that our hearts and our souls are fed as we come together to worship. And that's not enough sometimes. But Jesus, have mercy on me, a sinner, will always be heard by God. And gradually, God will lead you, be it ever so slowly, to the higher ground again. Some time ago, I read the biography of John Stott. He's very much involved with HTB. He was the vicar and minister there, who started the whole Alpha movement. And he was talking in his book about his conversion and what actually led to him inviting God into his life. And he wrote this: I was defeated. I knew the kind of person I was and the kind I longed to be. Between the reality and ideal, there was a great gulf. And what brought me to Christ was the sense of defeat and the astonishing news that the historic Christ offered to meet the very needs of which I was most conscious. And that great gulf between what John Stott wanted to be and what he actually was, coupled with the awareness of his own limitations, it became the very thing that was the gateway to understanding his needs for the mercy and the forgiveness of God. I recognise that same gateway. I recognise those moments of desperation in a different way to Steve. And it's one that I revisit, you know, from time to time again on my journey with Jesus, when I have to cry out for mercy again, for yet more grace to become all that Jesus had called me to be. So as Bartimaeus cried out, lots of people turned to him and told him, shh, be quiet. But he was having none of it. He cried out even louder, Son of David, have pity on me. And Jesus stopped and turned. And he said, call him. And in spite of all that noise, all that arguing, that whole atmosphere, Jesus heard him. He always hears the cry of our hearts. If you take nothing with you this morning, take this one thing, and the simple prayer that Steve's brought to us, have mercy on me, a sinner. You don't need fine words and complicated prayers to get the attention of Jesus. Jesus sent one of his disciples to find him and bring him to him. He could have spoken to him quite easily himself. But he has his own way of doing things, doesn't he, Jesus? He had a reason for that. He chose to involve the disciples because it would be better for them to get involved. It's better for his followers, for you and me, to get involved in the ministry of his kingdom. And so Jesus asked his disciples to call him and bring him to him. Jesus still calls his disciples, calls you and me, to bring others to him today, that they too can find what Bartimaeus found. It's Jesus who speaks first. He asks, "What do you want me to do for you?" Just imagine Jesus himself asking you, "What do you want me to do for you?" Bartimaeus' faith may have been small, but what he had, he used to call on Jesus. And so from the depths of his soul, he cries out, "Rabbi, I want to see." What would you cry out? Jesus spoke to Bartimaeus, "Go, your faith has healed you." Bartimaeus praised God and followed Jesus. What else would you do when you've been touched by the powerful healing love of Jesus himself? Jesus called Bartimaeus, healed him, even though he was on his way to Jerusalem, knowing that very soon he would be crucified. It's just a picture of the outrageous love that Jesus has for each one of us. On such a day, he had time for this beggar. There are many people who are physically blind, and in the UK at the moment there are over 2 million registered people who have sight loss. But there are many, many more people who are spiritually blind. And that spiritual blindness is greater and deeper, and it's darker than any physical blindness. Because spiritual blindness, it's separation from God, which means there's no hope, no light, and no life. I asked this young woman in the city if we could help in any way. She replied, "No, thanks." "Are you homeless?" I asked, and she said yes, and I asked if she had support that might help her get off to the street so that she'd be safe. She replied, "I'm all right, I've got my dog." And this dog was the softest dog I've met in a very long time. It wouldn't have afforded her any protection whatsoever. And sadly, she wasn't ready to move from the life that she'd become accustomed to. She chose to be the victim, to stay where she was. Some people do, for all sorts of complex reasons. When Jesus asked Bartimaeus, "What do you want me to do for you?" he knew exactly what he wanted. And he asked for sight and freedom, and Jesus healed him. Now, this makes uncomfortable reading, because we all have questions. Like, why doesn't God heal everybody? Why do children die? Why the tsunami? Why this? Why that? We don't have answers to our questions. But the one we're called to follow does have the answers. And he's still God. Godfrey Birtle sings a song called "Still God" and "Where is your presence, O God?" And he says he's still God, even when we're unbelieving. He's still God to everybody. He's still God through the things that hurt us. He's still God when the government has no answers. He's still God when our plans turn out to be worthless. He's still God when we lose our sense of purpose. And he's still God when we're rejected too. He's still God. And none of his resurrection power is diminished in any way as we wait for our restoration and our healing too. In Hebrews, I chose the message because I love what it says here. Now that we know what we have, Jesus, this great high priest, with ready access to God, let's not let it slip through our fingers. We don't have a priest who is out of touch with our reality. He's been through weakness and testing, experienced it all but the sin. So let's walk right up to him and get what he's so ready to give. Take the mercy and accept the help. So I think what to do now. Let's stand, shall we? Let's stand. Let's be still in the presence of God. And perhaps you'd like to open your hands in an attitude of readiness to receive from God, because this morning he longs to bless you. And perhaps close your eyes and imagine Jesus asking you this question: what do you want me to do for you?